This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of today's successful actors and directors got their start turning out low-budget quickies for my guest Roger Corman. People like Jack Nicholson, Martin Scorsese, John Sayles, Francis Ford Coppola, Robert Towne, and Robert De Niro. Corman has written a new book, How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. And yesterday, he told us just some of his techniques for making exploitation films. More about his work as a director, producer, and distributor today in part two of our conversation. Corman directed over 50 movies in the 1950s and 60s, including A Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, The Pit and the Pendulum, and The Wasp Woman. Since 1970, his companies New World Pictures and Concord produced hundreds of action and science fiction films. In 1966, Corman directed the movie Wild Angels, starring Peter Fonda as the head of a motorcycle gang. The movie not only launched Fonda's career, it helped give Fonda the idea of making Easy Rider. This is the story behind Corman's biker film.
There was a lot of talk about the Hells Angels at that time, and I remember in, it was either Time or Newsweek magazine, there was an article on them, and at the top of the page was a picture of a Hells Angels funeral. It took place in some woods, and they were carrying the coffin, but the members were riding their bikes. And the visual power of that photograph really impressed me. And I was having lunch with Jim Nicholson and Sam Arkoff, who ran American International, and we were talking about various ideas for a film that we might do together, and it kind of came up between all of us that we all thought the Hells Angels would be a good subject. So we agreed that we would do a film about the Hells Angels. I wanted the Hells Angels not to be the nemesis, the heavies. I wanted them to be the leads in the picture. So I developed with Chuck Griffith my own script, which eventually became the Wild Angels. And for a little while there, I and Chuck were hanging out with the angels, going to their parties and so forth. And the picture became a loose compendium of stories they told us about things that they had done.
So tell me what you were like when you were hanging out at Hell's Angels parties.
I was not quite one of the angels. I made a point of bringing the beer and possibly helping to bring some marijuana and one thing and others. And Chuck and I were reasonably well accepted, but we were never quite with them. I remember at one time I had spent a lot of the evening drinking beer and talking with the old lady that is the girlfriend of the president of the chapter of the Hell's Angels. And Chuck came over to me, and he said, "You're spending too much time talking to that girl. The leader of the angels has been watching you. He doesn't like it in any way whatsoever." And I realized for a little while I had forgotten what kind of party I was at and where I was. So I said goodbye to her and went over and talked to some guys about some bikes.
Now, you cast some actual Hell's Angels as extras in the movie, right?
Yes. We had members of the Venice and San Bernardino chapters of the Hell's Angels.
Did they give you any trouble?
No, they didn't really give me trouble. I was very careful as to how I was going to handle them. I thought about it, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to order them around, and that's not my style as a director anyway. On the other hand, I can't appear to be too weak because they'll start to push me around. So I determined that the thing to do was try to be as objective and unemotional as I could and simply to say, all right, fellas, the bikes start here. You're going to ride up to here, you're going to turn around that corner, and you're going to pull up in front of that bar over there, and you pull out and you run into the bar. And I would try to say it that way so it was clear what I wanted, but that I wasn't trying to force them to do anything. And I think they understood and appreciated that, and by and large, we got along pretty well.
Did you pay them well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't remember the exact amounts of money, but it was interesting. We worked out the payment. They got a certain amount of money per day for each angel, and then they got a little bit less than their personal fee to bring their bikes, and then they got a little bit less than the bikes for bringing their women. So this was their scale of values.
Didn't the Hells Angels sue you over one movie for using their name and insignia?
Yes, it wasn't so much the name and the insignia because I'd signed a contract with them, but after the Wild Angels came out and was successful, they sued me for defamation of character. And I remember watching television when the announcer said what announced the lawsuit, And he was evidently reading from a teleprompter or something. And he said, they were suing me because I had portrayed them as an outlaw motorcycle gang, when in reality, they were a social organization dedicated to the spreading of technical information about motorcycles. And the announcer started laughing in the middle of the television broadcast.
Peter Fonda starred in Wild Angels as like the head of the biker gang. He later starred with Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider. But in Wild Angels, there's something very innocent and vulnerable looking about him, in spite of the way that he's cast. Did you realize that at the time?
I knew that, and it was a little bit of a problem because I wanted Peter in the film. He was a good actor. He had the right persona, but he's a very tall, thin person, and he wasn't really as tough or as tough looking as the Angels. For that reason, I had him wear a couple of layers of clothing throughout the film in order to build up a little bulk. So I was aware of that, but I did what I could.
You made the movie The Trip, which was one of the first psychedelic features. Peter Fonda starred in that as someone who makes TV ads and decides to take his first trip. And most of the movie is what the trip is like. Now, the movie opens with a crawl and a voiceover narration. And the crawl says, the illegal manufacture and distribution of these drugs is dangerous and can have fatal consequences. This picture represents a shocking commentary on a prevalent trend of our time and one that must be of great concern to all. Is this a sentiment that you believed in, or was this obligatory to the genre, that, you know, to the teen genre? Not that this was a teen movie, but, you know, that you had to have a disclaimer before you actually started the psychedelic trip.
I'd like to disclaim the disclaimer.
Uh-huh.
I had nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Okay.
I shot the film, and American International was a little bit surprised when they saw it. They felt that maybe I'd gone a little bit farther than I might have, and they put that disclaimer on the picture themselves before they released it. I thought it was a bad idea, and I still think it's a bad idea.
Why?
I thought it was corny. The film stood on its own. I didn't think you had to say anything about the film. I think the film just should have played. They played around with the ending. I had set up a very intricate dolly shot ending up with Peter walking out of a house at the beach and looking at the sun as it was coming up. And it was a very difficult shot to get. And they cut that shot up in the final version of the picture and put some sort of a crack across the screen to try to show that his life was partially destroyed as a result of the trip, whereas the theme of the picture was open-ended, that something had happened to him, and I was not saying it was either good or bad. I was just saying here is a new day, something has taken place. The fact that they put that crack in, they thought would say that it was bad. The fact of the matter is it just looked kind of dumb, and I don't think the audience understood what it was about in any way.
Now, just as you hung out with the Hells Angels before making Wild Angels, you dropped acid once, I believe, before making The Trip.
Yes.
So how did that pay off in the making of the movie?
I think it was a necessary and a good experience to have made a picture about an LSD trip without having taken one. I think would have been almost disastrous. I would not really have understood what it was I was making the picture about. It did have an unintended effect, however, in that my trip was totally good. I had nothing but good images. And in trying to be fair, I then, in preparing the film, talked to people who had had bad trips and got some information and insight from them and tried to put elements of both good trips and bad trips in the picture because I was trying to be, as it were, impartial. I didn't want to make everything good.
Roger Corman is my guest. He's a producer, director, and distributor. He's made hundreds of movies. He's famous for making movies fast and cheap. Some of his movies include Little Shop of Horrors, Bloody Mama, The Wild Angels, Pit and the Pendulum, Tomb of Ligeia. Many actors and directors got their start working for him, including Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme, Joe Dante, Jack Nicholson, and John Sayles. So many of the actors, directors, and screenwriters who got their start with you moved on and made big-budget movies after that, which is something that you really never did. I'm sure you could have, But you chose to stay doing what you were doing. I mean, you formed your own company, so you were doing it for yourself, but you were still turning out quickies for the most part. Why did you want to keep doing that when you had the power and the money to make more expensive movies and to take a longer time doing it?
I had worked several times with the major studios, and as a matter of fact, I was offered a contract with a major studio to continue working for them when I stopped directing in 1970. The problem always seemed to be that a great deal of the decision-making was taken out of my hands. The studio would say, you're going to use this actor, or we want this approach, and I just felt more comfortable on my own. I felt that if I was going to make a mistake, I wanted it to be my mistake. I wanted to be able to make whatever type of film I wanted to make the way I wanted to make it. This, of course, as you say, did have the disadvantage of that it held me into lower budget films, although more recently my budgets have been climbing a little bit. But for most of my career, it has meant that in order to obtain independence, I had to do less expensive films.
Is it easier to make money, or is there more money to be made turning out a lot of cheaper movies than a few expensive ones?
It can go either way.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a film that breaks through for $100 million and make a great deal of money on that one film, yet you know that the majority of those big films will lose. So it's like shooting a three-point shot in basketball. The odds are against you hitting the three-point shot, but if you do hit, you get 3 points. Whereas if you're making lower budget films, it'd be like hitting 2-point shots. You're in there closer, you have a higher percentage of scoring, but you know that your score will be a little bit less on each individual shot.
In 1970, you gave up directing and you left American International Pictures to form your own company, New World Pictures. Why did you want to give up directing?
I was tired. I had directed a little bit over 50 pictures in about 15 years, and the last picture I directed was called Von Richthofen and Brown. It was a World War I flying picture that we were shooting in Ireland, primarily because there were some World War I planes in Ireland. And every morning, I was living in an apartment in Dublin, and every morning I would drive out to the airport, which was our base of operations. And on the way to the airport, there was a fork in the road, and to the right, it said Galway Bay, and to the left was the airport. And every morning, I was tempted to turn to the right, drive to Galway Bay, and just sit there looking out over the Atlantic Ocean. But dutifully, every morning, I drove to the airport and did my work. But I knew that I had to stop, that my heart really wasn't in it anymore. So I completed that film, and what I thought I would do is just take a year off, take the traditional sabbatical, and come back to directing. And I was offered a contract, as I said, at a major studio at the time, and I said, let me wait a year. I really don't want to do it now. And during that year, I thought what I might do is start a little production and distribution company, just as a partially as a hobby, as an investment, and just to have something to do, and then turn it over to somebody, and that was New World Pictures. It grew very rapidly, and I couldn't really find anybody I felt was qualified to take it over, so I ended up running it myself, and year followed year followed year, and I never did get back to directing until the Frankenstein Unbound project, and that actually was suggested to me by Universal Pictures. It wasn't even my idea to start with.
Did your approach to making movies change when you were overseeing production as the head of the production company as opposed to directing yourself?
My basic approach did not change and has not changed. However, being the production company, you look at the same problem from a somewhat different point of view. I still believe in a great deal of preparation, a tremendous amount of planning in the pre-production stages, and then shooting efficiently during the actual shooting schedule. And I talk with the directors I work with about that and try to instill that concept in them so that they're shooting to at least a certain extent in the style I feel comfortable with.
As a head of a production company, if somebody goes over budget or if they take a longer time to shoot than you had allotted, do you fire them?
I've never fired a director. but I will have some very strong conversations with him, and we really don't go much over budget or over schedule. We stay very close to our budgets and schedules.
Tell me a clever way that you perhaps came up with once to end a movie quickly after it started to go over budget or over length.
I remember one time when it was clear that a film was going over schedule. So I rearranged the schedule and had the director shoot the ending of the picture. And then I said to him, we've got the beginning and we've got the ending of the picture. You're over budget and over schedule. You have this many days that I'm giving you. Shoot whatever you want that's left in the picture in this allotted time. And when it's over, know that the picture is over, and whatever you shoot will be the picture.
Name some of the titles of recent movies that your company has produced.
Some of our recent releases are Body Chemistry, Streets, Blood Fist. Blood Fist, starring Don the Dragon Wilson, the world's light heavyweight kickboxing champion, was our biggest success this last year. Some of the films we've completed that are about to come out, Full Fathom 5, a submarine picture, will be coming out in a couple of months. Slumber Party Massacre Part 3 will be coming out. Blood Fist 2 will be with us in the fall. We've got a number of other films. We've got a picture that we start shooting in 2 weeks in Brazil called Fire on the Amazon, which is a thriller with a background of the destruction of the Brazilian rainforest. I have very high hopes for that film. We'll be shooting a picture in September in Germany and in Bulgaria called The Day the Wall Came Down, which is a spy story laid against the destruction of the Berlin Wall.
It'd take a movie like Blood Fist, Part 1. Now, I don't remember seeing that playing in my neighborhood. I don't remember seeing that playing in the nearby shopping malls. Where do movies like that play now?
A picture such as Blood Fist will play, for our company, somewhere between 500 and 800 dates in theaters dispersed pretty evenly throughout the country. We'll play, to a large extent, in suburban multiplexes, theaters with 3, 4, 5 or more screens. But even with a picture such as Blood Fist, which was a success for us theatrically, the bulk of the money came from home video. It was a moderate success for us theatrically, which is about all we can hope for anymore with a low-budget or medium-budget film. But it was a big success in home video. It sold almost 100,000 cassettes, which is a giant number for an independent film.
You know, in the same period that you were making movies like Blood Fist and Slumber Party Massacre, you were also distributing foreign films, films by Ingmar Bergman, Cries and Whispers. You distributed The Tin Drum. Why did you get into distributing art films? And this was in the late 70s or early 80s that you started doing this, I think. It had to be earlier than that.
It was the mid-70s.
Yeah.
I got into distributing art films simply because I wanted to do it. New World was growing very rapidly, and I was very pleased with the growth of the company, but I felt that we were becoming known too much as an American independent exploitation-minded company, and I wanted to change that image a little bit. And at the same time, I had always admired, as a matter of fact, I'd always loved the works of Bergman, Fellini, Truffaut, Kurosawa, and so forth, and I felt that their films were not really being distributed well in the United States. And I heard that Bergman's newest film at that time, Cries and Whispers, did not have an American distributor. And I remember telling Paul Koner, his agent, I'll take the picture sight unseen. And he said yes, and we made the deal, and I got a letter from Ingmar Bergman thanking me and then suggesting that I see the film and saying that he would give me an out and I could tear up the contract if I didn't like the film. Well, I saw the film and thought it was a wonderful film, and we distributed it, and it did very well.
Did you try distributing foreign art films to drive-ins and to the kinds of theaters that you were used to booking exploitation films in?
We did indeed. After Cries and Whispers had won the Academy Award, had played all the art theaters, had played some commercial theaters, there was a slight shortage of films at that time for drive-in. So we put it in a few drive-ins, and people were saying, you can't put an Ingmar Bergman film in a drive-in. And To everybody's surprise, the film did average business in drive-ins. The drive-in theater owners were very happy. They had a film, an additional film that did average business for them. We were happy. And I got another letter from Ingmar Bergman thanking me, saying that first, it was added revenue. And also, he was delighted that an audience that would not normally see his films was seeing them.
Roger Corman is my guest. In the fall, your movie Frankenstein Unbound will be released, the first movie you've directed in about 18 years. Why did you decide to go back into directing?
I actually didn't decide to go back into directing. A few years ago, Universal Pictures did some market research without telling me, but that's okay. And they did this research and came up with the information that a picture called Roger Corman's Frankenstein would be successful. And they asked me if I would like to make my comeback as a director and do Roger Corman's Frankenstein. And I said, as a matter of fact, I don't really want to do it. There have been so many Frankenstein pictures. It'd be the 85th or 90th Frankenstein picture, and I don't really have anything new to bring to the Frankenstein story, so I turned them down. And then Tom Mount, who'd been head of production at Universal, left to form his own company, the Mount Company, and he called me and said he had financing if I had any ideas. And then I remembered a book written by Brian Aldiss about 10 years earlier called Frankenstein Unbound, which I should have remembered earlier, but it was just out of my mind. And I said, I really liked that book because it was a completely original interpretation of the Frankenstein story. And I had a couple of ideas of my own that I thought could integrate with Brian's work, and we might make a very good picture. And so we agreed to do that. And it's a very, very strange picture that would be part horror film, part science fiction, and part fantasy. It is a pure entertainment on the surface level, and maybe somewhere beneath the surface, subtextually, there might be a little bit of statement about the meaning of science and its relationship to our culture.
How closely do you stay in touch with all the actors and directors and screenwriters who you gave their start?
I stay in reasonable touch with them. We're not all close or intimate friends anymore, but we see each other from time to time. For instance, Jack Nicholson, who not only starred in but directed Two Jakes, which is opening shortly, called me and offered me a part as an actor. He wanted me to play an establishment lawyer who he defeats in court with crooked evidence. And I said, Jack, why do you want to beat me in court with crooked evidence? But I couldn't play the part because I was directing Frankenstein Unbound at the time. But then after I finished Frankenstein, Jonathan Demme called me and asked me to play the head of the FBI in his picture, Silence of the Lambs. And I had time to play that, so I am indeed the head of the FBI.
You feel suited to the role?
Well, I keep being offered that type of role. You know, I'm not really an actor. But for Francis Coppola, I played a senator, and then I was offered the part of a lawyer. I played a district attorney for Paul Bartel.
So why is the king of exploitation being given all these roles as establishment figures?
I don't know. Maybe in their eyes, I am an establishment figure, and maybe it's a fact that I am growing older. However, Joe Dante had me play a bum, and I was delighted to play that.
Which movie?
The original Howling.
Okay. Roger Corman, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Roger Corman's new book is How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.